Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks so much for joining us this Sunday morning. Coming up in the next half hour, commentator Rebecca Ryan ruminates on her relationship with Facebook. We'll also bring you old case files from Dayton history and a conversation with Scottish filmmaker Stephen Lewis Simpson about his latest film, Neither Wolf Nor Dog. The film opens up at the Little Art Theater in Yellow Springs on July 24th. Up first, July marks nearly three decades since the Americans with Disabilities Act was signed into law. All this month, WISO is bringing you stories of Ohioans living with disabilities. It's our series, Just Ask, talking about disability. Today, WISO producer Anna Lurie brings us a conversation between Latif Brown and Todd Corthell. Both men suffered traumatic brain injuries in their 20s, and both are still grappling with recovery decades later.
My name is Latif Brown. I'm from Dayton, Ohio, and I'm going to be 40 years old this year on September the 2nd. I suffer from short-term memory loss, and it's the cause of I got into a car accident May 31st, 1997.
I'm Todd Corthell, and I am from all over, and I'm 54 years old now. And my accident happened when I was 22. I was not hurt so bad mentally, just physically. I have walk funny, I have a limp, I have poor speech. I have so many things I could tell you that just aren't right.
They told me that I was going to be in a coma for the rest of my life. And if I came out of my coma, I was going to be wheelchair bound, not able to walk, talk, read or write or anything again.
Oh, have you been able to remember better lately?
Well, it was kind of difficult at first because I had to learn how to walk, talk, read, write. It was like I was a newborn child all over again. I had to learn how to tie my shoes, put on my clothes, everything. When I got into my accident, I went through a bout of depression. I'm saying, wow, why did this happen to me? And I wasn't feeling good. And did you suffer from that?
I suffered from it for a little while. First, maybe 10 years. And then I got over it.
Okay.
And I've been in a happy mood ever since.
Okay. I was a very athletic and energetic person before I got into an accident. I played basketball every day.
Yeah.
Every day. And I look at basketball games now and I'll be like, man, whoa, I remember when I used to be able to do that.
That was kind of like me in golf. I would chase a little ball around in the snow.
Really?
Yeah. That ended. I can't swing club anymore.
Yeah.
I tried to, and I could hit the ball, but it just dribbled off the tee.
It wasn't the same, was it?
No.
I keep saying to myself, okay, I'm going to get back in shape. I'm going to start playing basketball again. Hey, what are your hopes and dreams and accomplishments for the future?
I hope I get rid of this lip I've got. I've been working on my physical exercises all the time at the gym. I usually go about every day. It's slowly working. But other than getting back in physical shape, I might get a job.
All right.
Well, I would like to find a woman and be happy.
That don't sound too bad.
Yeah. What are your plans for the future other than basketball? Do you have any?
I look at where I was and how far I've come, and I want to be an inspiration to other people with disabilities.
You are a great inspiration.
Thank you for telling me that.
You've been listening to Just Ask, talking about disability. And here's an update. Latif continues to advocate for people with disabilities. He's also planning to join a basketball league this summer. Todd participates in a disability support group, and he's still going to the gym every day. To hear more from our series, visit us at WYSO.org. Both of Ohio's United States senators weighed in this week on the latest Republican effort to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. For this week's Politics Ohio, we spoke with Joe Ingles from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Ingles says despite ongoing partisan rancor in Washington over health reform, Ohio's two senators are in agreement that some parts of the existing Affordable Care Act need to be changed. Joe, where do Ohio Senator Rob Portman and Senator Sherrod Brown stand on the latest GOP proposal to repeal the Affordable Care Act?
First of all, Senator Rob Portman, a lot of protesters, a lot of people have been targeting him with a lot of attention lately, but actually he has been against both versions that have come through the Senate. And one of the big sticking points for him is that he feels like there's not enough opportunity or options in many markets of Ohio. You can't even get an insurer under the Affordable Care Act. You know, I'm talking about these people who go on there. Maybe they don't qualify for the Medicaid expansion itself, but yet they want to buy some affordable insurance. So they go on there, they find that there is no insurer in their county. There are 19 counties, apparently, in Ohio that have no insurers whatsoever, and another 27 that only have one. So that's been a big issue for Senator Portman. And he says he's just not comfortable with the way that some of the things are worded in it right now and the way that they're doing it, but he would like to see reform. But ironically, so would Senator Sherrod Brown. Senator Sherrod Brown says there are some problems with the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare or whatever we're calling it. He says there are some problems with that because he says that things needed to be fixed, and he's calling for a bipartisan group, including him and Senator Portman, to sit down and look at some of the problems with Obamacare. In particular, he would like to see Obamacare try to deal with some of these massive increases that have been taking place, cost increases, insurers pulling out. And he wants to try to fix some of the little problems with it and make it more financially sustainable. So what I'm hearing from them is there is an agreement that they think that there are fixes that need to be made. But then as his campaign progressed, he said, you know, really, I think we need to reform it, you know, repeal and replace it. So that's what he was talking about as he was going through the election process. But I think at one point he really did kind of favor just, you know, blowing it up. He's not for that now. He's very clear that, you know, he thinks that that would be disastrous.
We have both Ohio senators now expressing interest in working together in a bipartisan way. Is that a new thing, largely due to the Trump administration?
Actually, I don't think it is all that new. There are a lot of times when I see legislation that has gone through the Senate or, you know, that is working its way through that both Ohio senators agree on. They are, both senators and Portman are united on a lot of things, especially if it involves the Great Lakes, for example. If it involves trade many times, they're on the same page. And the big problem, Jerry, right now is we have this opiate crisis in Ohio. And a lot of the people who are victims of this opiate crisis, or if you want to call them victims, some people don't like that term, but, you know, people who are needing help, they're finding that this Medicaid expansion and the Obamacare is helping these folks get the help that they need to be able to break out of it. And, you know, that's something that this opiate addiction is costing the state a lot of money every year in lost productivity. And it's something that all of our lawmakers on both sides of the aisle have been concerned about for quite some time, as evidenced with the budget, because they just threw millions of dollars in the budget to try to deal with the opiate crisis. So that's something that we hear a lot about from Senator Portman, We hear it from Senator Brown. We hear it from Governor Kasich. We hear it from a lot of lawmakers, and it seems to be more of a bipartisan issue in that regard.
Joe Ingles with the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks for your time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Find more of our series, Politics Ohio, on the website at WISO.org. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us. On July 24th, the independent film Neither Wolf Nor Dog opens up at the Little Art Theater in Yellow Springs. The film is based on the award-winning novel by Kent Newbern and features a remarkable performance by Elder Dave Bald Eagle, who was 95 years old at the time of filming. To talk about the film, we spoke with its filmmaker, Stephen Lewis Simpson, by phone from his home in Scotland. Stephen, thanks for joining us. Neither Wolf Nor Dog opens at the Little Art Theater in Yellow Springs on July 24th. Tell us what was behind your effort to get behind this movie and put it on film.
Yeah, I mean, the story basically revolves around a white author, Kent Newbern, that's actually based on the author himself of the book, who gets a call out of the blue from the granddaughter of a Lakota elder asking him to come visit him, and basically gives him this proposition of distilling his life down into the form of a book. And after a few false starts, essentially the psychic of the author destroys all the notes that were going to be the basis of it, and they decide, instead of creating the sanitized version of native life, as is often the way, in terms of how some of the historical texts have been written, they instead suck him into this road trip through the heart of the elder's world, so that he sees the entire experience, sort of warts and all, and sees his perspective firsthand, but in very much challenging him and his own perceptions along the way. You know, Dave Bald Eagle was of an era that, he just passed at 97. They're more or less all gone, these elders from this generation. And it's not even just about, you know, the age of somebody. It's really how and when they grew up. I mean, Dave was brought up around people who were, you know, as they would say, born free. I mean, his grandfather was at the Little Bighorn and still grew up around all those traditional ways, that have pretty much all, for the most part, you know, died out in terms of, you know, that sort of direct line. And so, you know, it was very much about, you know, here's the last sort of chance to document, you know, a lot of that perspective, as, you know, that sort of the form the novel took. But the film takes that and almost takes it to a different level, using the different medium, in the sense that when we're at Wounded Knee, you know, I abandoned what was in the novel and in the script and had Dave improvise the entire sequence, because we had the privilege of having the real thing there, and where he took us through that sequence was more powerful than anything that Kent Newbern or, you know, that I myself could write. And it ended up in this sort of incredibly moving and powerful sequence. And so, you know, the film in itself almost steps away from being a narrative into almost documentary at that point. And, you know, it is an incredible privilege to bring that to an audience, because I know, you know, at the end of filming that, Dave turned to Christopher Sweeney, who played Newbern, and said, you know, I've been holding this in for 95 years. And, you know, he's speaking in a sense, you know, for an entire generation that you know, all still had the same, you know, resonance through their lives of, you know, the echo of Wounded Knee and boarding schools and all these other things.
The film has a very rich look, but this was financed by donors, by audience members that know your work, and it was filmed in a very short time. Is that correct?
It is, yes. I mean, it is one of those things. It's a micro-budget film. It was crowdfunding through Kickstarter that made it all possible. And, you know, I had a crew of two, and we filmed it incredibly quickly. And but at the same time, you know, I never think that that's a reason for, you know, sloppiness in filmmaking. A lot of independent films all look the same, you know, handheld and no attention to detail. Whereas, you know, I mean, the great thing about shooting in the Great Plains, you can point the camera anywhere and you've got a beautiful shot if you, you know, just no, you know, basic composition. And so, you know, the film has a really lush feel because the landscapes, but also the characters themselves. I mean, they, you know, were so rich in themselves, and, you know, Dave Bald Eagle in particular, was just remarkable to film and to light. And, you know, so that just elevates the whole experience of the film, I think, and as a visual piece.
Tell us a little bit more about Dave Bald Eagle. He passed away just this year, correct, at 97?
Well, it's actually on Saturday. Well, this weekend, it's going to be a year since his passing. And, yeah, I mean, he was just as unique an individual as you could ever imagine. You know, his life experience, you know, was more elaborate than that of pretty much any character you've ever seen on film. I mean, from being left for dead on D-Day to being a rodeo rider and race car driver to having this extraordinary extended family. And, you know, that all, you know, inhabits him on screen. There's a richness to his entire presence. I think it's, you know, truly one of those characters that when people, you know, after they've seen this film, they literally never will ever forget him. He's that memorable. I mean, he was 95 when we filmed, and it was his, you know, debut starring performance. He'd had some smaller roles in films over the years, but, you know, nothing to match this scale. And, you know, that just showed his fearlessness taking on a role like this.
As I've mentioned, it looks like a very lovely and a rich, beautifully shot film. What has the reaction been when, kind of in this age when the box office is ruled right now by superheroes, and this is kind of a different character, a different hero?
Well, you know, it's truly remarkable. You know, this is, as I say, a very small film in how it was made, and, you know, the industry doesn't really pay attention to that sort of thing. So I started releasing it myself and have been slowly working it around the country, and it's been quite a phenomenon. In the states that we've been in, we've been playing a higher proportion of screens than many of the much bigger independent films. You know, in one town in Washington State, we were the second best performing film of their year and beat 11 of the 12 blockbusters playing down the road. You know, just recently we've been in multiplexes, literally in the next theater to Spider-Man and all these sorts of things. And that's, you know, pretty much unheard of, even just with an independent film in general, for something being self-distributed to get this sort of reaction. And it's remarkable because, as you say, it's a 95-year-old star, and it's a very, you know, slow, meaningfully paced film. But there's one thing that Hollywood, with all their millions, cannot buy, and that is heart. And that's what this film has more than anything. You know, and, you know, Dave Bald Eagle puts his spirit on screen, and that's what's having such a deep impact with the audience. I mean, our Rotten Tomatoes score with the audience is 4.8 out of 5, and find any of the blockbusters out there at the moment that's, you know, getting that response from the audience. I mean, it's been touching them in a profound way. Constantly hearing of, you know, in multiplexes in Midwest, applause at the end of the film and people being rooted to their seats long after the lights come up. And, you know, it's just remarkable. And, you know, I like to take credit for some of it, but at the end of the day, I know it's because, you know, Dave Bald Eagle and the rest of the cast is remarkable, but Dave Bald Eagle touches them in this very, very special way.
We've been speaking with Scottish film director Stephen Lewis Simpson about his film adaptation of the acclaimed best-selling novel Neither Wolf Nor Dog. It opens at the Little Art Theater on July 24th. Stephen, thanks so much for your time. And just briefly, can you tell us what's next for you?
Well, I mean, basically, I've not had a day off since November with the distribution, and that's going to at least fill up this year. And then, you know, from then on, it's just, you know, back to the drawing board and you know, hopefully shooting a movie in Europe early in the next year.
Great. Good luck with this film, and we're really looking forward to seeing it here in Yellow Springs. Again, thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Check out other upcoming events at the Little Art Theater in Yellow Springs at littleart.com. Every year, Dayton History produces a play at the Old Montgomery County Courthouse. Each play is a reenactment of a high-profile criminal case that made headlines in Dayton. The series is called Old Case Files. Like all good mysteries, there are twists and turns, but these cases are a little different. Even the actors don't know the outcome. Community Voices producer Jason Reynolds has our story.
All rise for the Honorable Judge Mason Douglas and remain standing. Court is now in session.
At the Montgomery County Courthouse in downtown Dayton, the cast of Old Case Files is rehearsing. The story is ripped from the headlines, but not today's headlines. It's a murder case from 1935, when, on Christmas Eve, a former police officer shot a man 5 times at the Postal Telegram office on 3rd Street. To at least one passerby, it seemed pretty cold-blooded.
Did you see Mr. Parker run?
No, he looked very casual.
What do you mean?
Well, he came outside, twirling his gun around his finger. He did that with his right hand, and with his left, he rolled a cigarette.
Huh.
That's a witness, played by Aaron Ossendorf, being questioned by a trial attorney, played by Tim Lyle. As it turns out, the shooter, Lewis Parker, had motive to kill the deceased, Thomas Payne. Payne had run off with Parker's wife, and children, and car. Parker's wife was more than willing to go. She'd been having an affair with Payne for some time, and everything came out at trial. Here, Parker, who is played by Wayne Wolfe, testifies on his own behalf. He's questioned by one of his defense attorneys, played by Scott Stoney.
Did your wife, when she became ill last summer, accuse you of passing an infectious disease onto her?
She did. And she said it had to be me because she had no dealings with any other man.
What else did she say about her illness?
She said she believed she should go away to recuperate.
Needless to say, Mrs. Parker was recuperating with her lover, who would later be shot by Mr. Parker. But Mr. Parker says it was self-defense, that Payne was reaching for a gun. Margaret Piot is the writer and director of Old Case Files, which is now in its 7th season.
It is different than creative writing. It's not quite like being a playwright who sits down and creates a story out of his or her imagination and experience. Instead, I think of it as a little bit like starting off with a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle.
It's a jigsaw puzzle because there usually aren't transcripts from cases this old. Piot has to research.
And so the most creative part is really coming up with the questions, because the newspapers, which I read, the newspapers from the time period, after I have fitted them together, I usually know what the witnesses said, but I don't know what was asked to make them say that.
Authenticity and accuracy are important to these reenactments. And there's a whole team that does research, including Sandy Lemming. While each case is different, Lemming says that every year there are audience members who come to see their ancestors portrayed.
The very first year we had descendants of the man who was the murderer, who was convicted and executed, and they came up to us afterwards. We didn't know they were going to be in the audience, and so we were really wondering what kind of reaction they would have to putting on this trial, which kind of proved their ancestor was a murderer. But they were actually very appreciative.
And the actors sometimes feel a strong connection to the works. Take Jim Charters, for example, who plays the bailiff in this year's production.
I wish my dad were still alive because I know he knew these attorneys. It's a shame he's not still around. We could have some interesting talks.
After the attorneys make their closing statements, the bailiff chooses a dozen audience members at random, and they have 10 minutes to decide the fate of Lewis Parker. Scott Stoney plays a defense attorney. He says writer and director Margaret Piot doesn't take it easy on those audience members.
She works very hard to get a balance between the two cases, so that when we start with actual audiences and actual juries, they really have to consider both sides. It's not a slam dunk for either side.
While the writing may try to give the actors a level playing field, Stoney says the same can't be said for society at large.
And the thing that's interesting about it is that juries, especially because you're pulling them from the audience, are very much reactive to the current political scene. If there are trials going on during our case, many times we've had juries that are feeling very frustrated because someone's not getting justice or someone's not being put into jail that should be, and they will take it out on in our cases.
If you want to see how Stoney and the rest of the cast does, and learn what the real jury had to say in 1935, Old Case Files opens this week. For Culture Couch at WYSO, I'm Jason Reynolds.
Old Case Files runs Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays now through August 6th. Visit WYSO.org to see photos of the actors and for more information about the show. Culture Couch is made possible in part by a generous grant from the Ohio Arts Council. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WYSO Weekend on WYSO. Thanks for joining us. Earlier this week, Google began experimenting with a new interest curation app that aims to compete with Facebook. And lately, commentator Rebecca Ryan has been thinking about her relationship with that social network.
The other day, I was looking at my list of Facebook friends and wondered, if I died tomorrow, how many of them would actually come to the funeral? The truth is, most of them would not, and would, in fact, post about it the next day on Facebook. OMG, did you hear about what happened to Rebecca? It's not that I surround myself with heartless people who wouldn't care if I died, but Facebook friends most often are not real friends. They're just an audience we keep at arm's length to stroke our own egos with their likes and comments. We do the same in turn for them. So why devote my time and energy to friends who sort of exist, but sort of do not? It's nice to stay in touch on Facebook, but staying in touch means that person is a part of your life. You talk to them. You see them. You know their middle name. Being on Facebook takes me down the fast track to being nosy, judgmental, and competitive. But I rationalize those harsh things by saying, oh, it's nice to stay in touch. I often catch myself scrolling through Facebook filled with jealousy at vacations others take or judgment at choices I wouldn't make or opinions I don't have. I click on some photos and suddenly find myself so far in the rabbit hole that I'm now nosing through their entire photo album. And these are often people I haven't seen in decades, so why do I care that they're in sombreros giggling in the sand? I would not go into their homes and plop myself on their couch and leaf through their personal photos, so why do I feel entitled to do so online? This is the exact opposite of what I deem a good use of my time on Earth. So, you'd think I'd stop. I don't use Facebook only as a means to fan the fires of my unhealthy jealousy, nosiness, and judgment. I actually do like knowing people from my past are still out there making their way in the world. It's fun to see that the buddy I had in sixth grade is now a successful real estate agent, or the ex-boyfriend who dumped me turned out to be someone I wouldn't want to be with anyway. I can't lie, this quiet validation is a fun bonus of Facebook. The raw, honest truth is I do look to Facebook for affirmation. My Facebook friends are mere cheerleaders put firmly in place to tell me how awesome I am. I worked out today and my Facebook friends gave me the thumbs up. I saw a donkey at the hardware store and they posted a laughing emoji. Ha! I'm funny! I made dinner and they told me I'm a good mom. Nice. I get credit and acknowledgement just for merely existing, and who would not love that self-absorbed adulation? When I let it, Facebook does give me a sense of camaraderie. When I see my high school friends turning gray or struggling with raising their kids just like I do, I have a feeling of connection, as false as it may be, that we are going through the same thing. And maybe herein lies the answer. More real moments. Less touting the pretty, polished, sing-song parts of life, and more of sharing the difficult, imperfect drudgeries that can be on the path of adulthood. Sure, my kids are great students who help with chores, so I'm quick to post about that, but they're also pains in the butt with whom I find myself screeching, "I am not your personal servant!" That vulnerable reality does not seem to make it to Facebook, but it should. We can now add political turmoil to the list of things Facebook seems to foster. I now hide behind the protection of a like or dislike button instead of engaging in real conversations that challenge me. It's almost as though I've given Facebook permission to hijack my actual communication skills and replace them with a thumbs up or a thumbs down. What will be next? A caveman grunt? What bothers me the most is that Facebook has begun to suck out the intention and authenticity of moments in my life. I can't take a photo of a sunset just for my personal enjoyment. I must share and get instant cyber pats on the back for it. So much so that I have not savored the moment that just passed. Does this mean I'm going to get off Facebook? No. And of course, I'm secretly hoping you'll become my Facebook friend. But I do want to learn how to turn off the life-sucking noise I let it bring. I want to focus more on the real people in my life, the people who know all the imperfect edges of me. I want to quietly love my kids without announcing it to cyber friends whom I'll never invite over to see it for themselves. If I put as much energy into my real friends that I do my Facebook friends, I know the quality of my life will go way up. And that certainly deserves a clapping hands emoji, right? For WYSO, I'm Rebecca Rhine.
That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. I'm Jerry Kenny. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10. We hope you'll join us. Coming up next on WYSO, it's Vic McCunis with The Book Nook.